Hello, and thank you very much for listening to this episode of the Billy Newman Photo Podcast. Today I was going to be talking about some of the ideas around VR rendering. I've been just getting into that after recording a ton of 4K, I think actually 5.2K video with the GoPro Fusion. I've just talked about a lot of that stuff on the last Flash Briefing, but today I've been bringing it over onto my MacBook Pro, which is really quite a modern version of the computer, and I think as many of the pros comment recently, it's probably the better iteration of the MacBook Pro for the last number of years. I'll get into that and some of the Apple WWDC news just in a few seconds, but for some of the VR rendering that I'm doing on it, without maybe a dedicated graphics card to push through it, as you know, at a faster clip, it takes a long time. So I'm trying to export 360 degree equirectilinear video footage in 4K MP4 file formats. What is it? I don't know, in H.264, to throw in some other term that someone might not understand. I've been trying to do that overnight. So I've been using a command. If you have a Macintosh, this is a good one to learn. If you go into your terminal, I think you can use the command caffeinate, just the word caffeinate, and then /D, and that will force your MacBook or your iMac or your Apple computer to remain on and to not go to sleep under the normal circumstances that your settings would have precluded it to do. So it's a really cool little bit if you're just trying to make your computer stay on or force it to stay on for a longer amount of time. It leaves the screen on too. You gotta do your little F1, F2 thing or something to turn that down. But it works really well though. I've been using that to leave the computer on and have it running so that it can be churning through some of these 4K rendering jobs that I have the computer set up to do overnight while I'm sleeping. So I put the computer out in another room, and then I have a queue of video set up for it to stitch together. This GoPro stitching stuff for the GoPro Fusion software is really intensive. I'll get into that some other time, but man, the stitching software is just and you imagine what it has to do to stitch hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of frames all in like 5K or something to make it almost like seamless, or make it look good instead of just some kind of blurry line. So I'm amazed that it can do any of that sort of stuff at all, but it's fascinating as it is, but it takes a long time, and it's interesting to get to the point where you're like, oh man, this computer can't really do like a professional job like this. And that's where you think you almost hit the limit of the need for computing, or the need for a lot of the processor speed, or the specs of a computer. And you think that for a lot of web-based desktop publishing stuff or phone-based mobile publishing stuff, we've really maxed out the need for the speed of a lot of the components. But then you come into a position like this where you're starting to do higher level compiling or higher level rendering of compiling like a code base or something, or trying to render out some of these higher file format video files. You really notice like how long it takes and how much you would really have an improved job by having an improved machine. And so I think that's where like a lot of stuff like the Pro line of Apple hardware comes into play, like the iMac Pro that came out earlier this year. And that's, I guess it's been semi-well received by some of the pros. There's just that huge part where you can't upgrade it. It's definitely an iMac computer. So it's going to be strong and, capable at video, or capable at the Thunderbolt expansion to whatever that would mean for you. But it doesn't really have expandable slots or, expandability within the frame of the computer. And even really the cylinder Mac Pro didn't have the expandability that they thought it would have. And I think that was also part of the graphics card architecture that they used doesn't really ended up getting updated. There's a whole kind of snafu around stuff around that, where that's why that computer didn't really get updated in the fashion that they maybe thought it would have. And that's, I think, why like a lot of the more modern 5K monitor iMacs are faster computers, or higher spec computers have, a newer generation architecture for their core processor than even the highest spec cylinder MacBook Pro would at this point. I guess given that it came out in 2013 and hasn't really seen a whole update yet since then. So, or I don't know, minor update, just simple component stuff, but not, it was just kind of internally within the spec, but I don't think there's actually been like an actual rendition that's been new from that yet. So that kind of brings me, I guess, to the last point, which is that Apple's WWDC is supposed to be coming up here real soon in just the beginning part of June here. And that's when we're supposed to get some information about, I guess it would be the developer preview for iOS 12 and some of the news or rumor, well, I guess rumors would be currently what they are. After WWDC is when we're going to get the confirmation from Apple about the direction in design and feature choice that's going to be going into iOS 12. And maybe we'll get some hints on the types of devices or the, I don't know, maybe it's going to lean heavily to AR. Maybe it's going to lean heavily to the gesture format that we've started seeing in the iPhone X kind of versioning of iOS 11. I don't know yet, but hopefully we'll see some Siri improvements. Seems like that's gotten long in the tooth after a little while, especially kind of starting to see now, given, you know, like this and what the Echo is capable of. And well, I guess some of those Google demos that we saw a few weeks ago about artificial intelligence parsing the verbal cues of what people are saying and trying to have that fill out a form of data. It's interesting stuff.
You can see more of my work at billynewmanphoto.com. You can check out some of my photo books on Amazon. I think you can look up Billy Newman under the authors section there and see some of the photo books on film, on the desert, on surrealism, on camping. Some cool stuff over there.
And I wanted to jump into a couple of the things I've been doing through the month of July and some of the outdoor camping and travel stuff I've been up to. I was going to run down some of that in this podcast today. I wanted to talk about a trip I did out toward eastern Oregon. I think like last, or what, it was a week before last is when I was out in this area. And I was trying to get some good observations in for Comet NEOWISE. I'm not sure if any of you guys got to check that out while it was in its prime viewing section there. I think that was while we had kind of like the new moon before it switched over to being a gibbous moon or a nearly full moon like it's been the last week or so. But I think, what was it, around like the 15th through the 25th or so of July, there were some pretty good observations to be made of Comet NEOWISE. And I guess after kind of reading about it a little bit, it's not considered a great comet like Hale-Bopp was, or I think it was it Hayutake in 1996. We haven't had a great comet in a long time. I remember seeing those when I was a kid, though, and that was pretty cool, watching Hale-Bopp come through for, it seemed like 3 months or something, you know, that you were just kind of looking at that in the low corners of the northwestern and western sky as it was kind of cruising across the skyline there. I remember that still from like third, fourth grade, when it was coming through. And I also remember the year before that when like straight up in the air, straight up in the sky at night for, it was only like a week or so. I was a kid, you know, but I remember for that week, you could see a real bright two-tailed comet that was going through. I can't remember how to pronounce it. I think it's Hayutake, or I think it's some Japanese name, I'm pretty sure. But that was a really cool one. That one I still remember really clearly. And I was only like, I don't know, 7 or something when that comet came through. But I really appreciated getting to make some observations of that one when I was a kid. I missed Halley's Comet, though, back in, what, 87, I think was the last one it came through. And I probably will be the few years or that, you know, that decade or two of age range that doesn't get to see Halley's Comet in their lifetime. So I think I was born in 88, of course. So if I make it past 100, then maybe I'll see it. What is it? Maybe like 80 something years. So it's probably not going to come back around until, I think it's like the 2070s or 2080s that I'd have to make it to for see Halley's Comet again. It'd be fun, but I don't know. Maybe we'll see how the future is at that time. But it was really cool to get to see Comet NEOWISE. It was just a little below what would be the legs and feet of Ursa Major, the Big Dipper, or like the Big Bear, as it would kind of be observed. But if you kind of look at the Dipper part that we're all mostly familiar with, if you kind of consider Ursa Major, the larger bear constellation that it's structured on, if you kind of look down below the Dipper is where I was able to make my observations of Comet NEOWISE. And over here in the elevation area that I'm at, in Western Oregon. It's about 200 or 300 feet above sea level. And there's kind of a constant problem with haze and with light pollution in this area. And I think it has to do something with, of course, you know, the amount of population that's around. But also, there's something about the air quality or about how the air kind of flows out around here that just doesn't ever seem to be as crisp or as dark as you can get up in the mountains. And really, it's just like a stunning difference when you're able to get out further and make some more clear observations. It's just, you know, the level of magnitude of stars that you're able to reveal just in a dark night is so much more crisp and clear. It's just a total difference. So it was cool to, I think I first was able to spot just a little fuzzy bit of a second magnitude version of Comet Neowise while I was here in town. But I tried to make a special trip out toward Eastern Oregon, out into the desert, just to do some camping stuff. But what I wanted to do at the same time was make some good observations and also try and get some good photographs of Comet Neowise as it was coming through during its period, where you could make some good sightings of it. But it was cool. So going out to Eastern Oregon, as it got dark, a little past 10:30 or so, as you look to the northwest, you could really see the comet and its tail spread for a couple inches in the sky. And I was really surprised to notice how little of it you could really make out or see when you're in an area of almost any light pollution. Once you're back in town or once you're in a lower elevation area with some light pollution and haze around, it was really difficult to make out in the same way that I could out in the desert or out in the mountains. And so I thought that was pretty cool to get to see and get to check out over there. But it was a blast getting to do some stuff out in Eastern Oregon. I went over to the John Day River area. And I was checking out that area. There's a lot of public land out in that area, but there's also a lot of private land too. It's just kind of an interesting area how it's sort of broken up. And it was cool to get to go out to, though. I headed out to Madras, and then I took off and headed over east of there until I ran into the John Day River. And then I was able to use this map that I have to go through and find some of the open roads that are, the smaller gravel roads that are set up to kind of traverse the backcountry out there. So I was able to find a few of those that were open and travel around on those for a while. And that was pretty cool. I was able to find some dispersed campsites and set up right along the John Day River, which was really cool. It's a beautiful area out there. It's kind of interesting. The John Day River flows through this sort of, I guess it would be, I don't know, it's kind of like canyon land, and it's also sort of these rolling grass hills that sort of make up the landscape of northern and northeastern Oregon. And I think, as soon as you kind of get a little bit north of Bend is when you get out of the Great Basin area and you start to get into another kind of landscape that seems to stretch up north of the Columbia River up into Washington. I've heard that some of it's from like really old deposits from the river systems and the waterways that were up there and how were like there's old deposits and then erosion that's happened from those rivers running through the area for such a long time. But really cool to see kind of the rolling hills and then some of the carved out canyons that go through the John Day River area up there. When I found the campsite I was at, I was pretty far away from everybody, and I was really far away from any substantial town. I think it was near, I don't even know what it is. There wasn't anything there when I drove through. There was a bridge and a couple little ranch houses, real ranches, right? Like a little house, like a little two-bedroom house, and then 100 acres of cattle to deal with. So it seems like another life out there. I wonder how they're dealing with, kind of the way of the world as things are this summer. But it was cool, getting out there. Kind of set up my campsite and stuff, had my truck going. And that was all pretty easy going. But then I waited till dark after 10:30. Yeah, Comet Neowise was really visible up below the Big Dipper. That was pretty cool to get to see out there in Eastern Oregon. Really bright, really clear. You could almost make out the second tail. I had my binoculars with me. And I think there's some 10 by 42s. And those worked really well to view it, to view the comet. Looked really crisp through the binoculars, and yeah, really easy to spot most of the night. Even just to the naked eye, it was really easy to spot it. Just like, oh yeah, it's right there. There's a comet. It's just a big wisp in the sky So it was really cool to get to view it. What I did is I set up my tripod and I have my camera with me. And so I set it up with a really wide angle. And then I was trying to get some photographs of it as the comet was sort of coming down to set on the landscape of the hillside, you know, as the hours went on into the night. So I think I stayed out until maybe 1 or 2 in the morning when the Big Dipper was sort of scooping down a little low onto the horizon. And then at that point, the place where the comet was dipped below the horizon and then was out of view for the rest of the evening and I think even into the morning. I think by that time when I was photographing it, it wasn't visible any longer up in the morning sky. I think they said, you know, at first in early July, you could kind of view it around Capella if you were able to get out early enough, say 3 or 4 in the morning. But as it was moving, it was kind of creeping up pretty quickly, you know, day over day over day, it would kind of move a good chunk through the sky. And in the direction that it was moving to be more visible at the nighttime, which really offered more hours of good observation time, which I thought was pretty cool to wait until it was really dark enough in the northwest view of the sky. Probably about 10:30 onward is when you're finally able to make out those kind of finer points of light in the sky in that region. So it was really cool. Set up the tripod, set up the camera, set up some manual focus to get it kind of set sharp at night. You know, you can't use autofocus when you're trying to make photographs of the night sky and the stars because it just kind of seeks back and forth. So you have to set it to manual focus and then ring out your focus ring to infinity and then just back a little bit. You'll notice this every time if you do it. It's really frustrating in the dark because you can't really always make it out in an easy way and edit your mistake quickly. But if you go all the way to infinity and then take pictures there of the night sky, you're going to notice that those points of light that are the stars sort of end up a little fuzzy. And it's because all the way to infinity, for whatever reason, just isn't quite in focus at infinity. So you have to go all the way out to infinity and then back it off just a little bit. And that'll nearly ensure that most of that part of the image is in focus the whole way. And it's difficult, even if you do have an f-stop that's a little bit more tightened out, say like an f4 or f6 or something, you're still going to get a lot of that out of focus softness if the focus ring isn't really dialed into the right spot. So I tried to work on that a little bit and dialed in my focus, was able to set it up with a reasonable ISO to get some images of the night sky and pick up some of those finer points of light. And then I was able to take a series of photographs in a few different locations out there in the John Day River Valley, which I thought was really cool. It was pretty to be out there, and it was a nice night, really warm in the River Canyon, and really remote too. Like I was mentioning, I think I was the only person out there for a few miles. I saw another group coming in on they had a little midsize SUV, and they were going fishing out at a bend in the river a couple miles up from where I was. And so I took my truck down a little further and camped out just on the side of the river. It was cool. Nice green river up to the kind of high desert tan rim rock that runs the area around there. So it was a cool evening, cool campsite area. It was a cool spot to check out Comet Neowise too. So I tried to check it out up until, I don't know what, 1:30 in the morning when I couldn't see it anymore. And then spent the night out there, out in the John Day River area. And then the next morning got up and tried to check out some of the different roads and stuff that went around. You can check out more information at billynewmanphoto.com. You can go to billynewmanphoto.com/support if you want to help me out and participate in the value for value model that we're running this podcast with. If you receive some value out of some of the stuff that I was talking about, you're welcome to help me out and send some value my way through the portal at billynewmanphoto.com/support. You can also find more information there about Patreon and the way that I use it if you're interested or feel more comfortable using Patreon. That's patreon.com/billynewmanphoto. Also interested in, as I've spoken about before on this podcast, is I have an affinity for taking photographs on film. And I want to get back into that in a way, because right now I don't really have a film camera with me. I still have the
Nikon N80 floating around, though I'm short a lens. Or, you know, that's what I'm saying, is like I've kind of made an investment now into this whole range of focal lengths that I have, and really quite nice pieces of glass over on the Canon side now. And so I'd like an opportunity to be able to take those photographs on film with that range of glass that I now have available to me. So what I'm looking at trying to do is trying to pick up one of these older now, one of the last runs of film cameras that Canon had put out. And so I was looking around and trying to do some research for that. When I had talked to you guys before about it in the podcast, I was mentioning that I had picked up a Nikon F4, a camera that was the full manual camera, it wasn't full manual. I think it was autofocus, and it had like a whole color matrix. It was one of the first cameras to have that color matrix auto system in it, where you could kind of like set it up. But and the N80 has a lot of those same features too. What I'm trying to do to get to the point is I'm looking at the EOS line of film cameras that Canon had produced in the 1990s and in the 2000s. And there's a lot of opportunities there where you can really pick up a very nice camera body that, you know, will shoot film, and that would kind of accompany the 5D Mark III and all the Canon lenses that I have now. So I was looking at the EOS 1N, which I think is the camera that came out in 1994. It really looks quite a bit like a 5D body shape, where it's not the oversized body, but it looks, you know, just kind of like that camera SLR body style. And it has a bunch of the features on the back. I think it has that roller wheel that Canon users have come accustomed to. It probably was one of the first cameras to introduce that big roller wheel to control your f-stop, and then the other roller on the front to control your aperture. So it's interesting how it's laid out, but it feels and looks almost the same way. So I'm looking around at those. Those came out in 1994, and then in the year 2000, they had come out with the EOS 1... Did I say 1N before? What was it? I think I wrote it down over here, though I can't remember what it was. There was the 1N and maybe the 1H? That doesn't sound right. What would it have been? Let's look here. Oh, the 1V. That's, I think, the one I'm looking for. Yeah, the 1V is the film camera that Canon produced in the year 2000 and probably up through like 2006 or 2007 or 2008. There's probably even new versions of that body that are still around if there's those hardcore film users out there. So I'm looking around at some of those, and on the used market, I think they're like $300-$500 if it's kind of on the higher end of expense. But I'm looking at some of those, and it seems like it'd be kind of an interesting purchase to pick one of those up. Then I could be shooting film images like I've had an interest in doing with a professional body that kind of matched a lot of the same layout and workflow that the 5D Mark III that I'm using has. So I'm pretty interested in that. And then I could use all this L glass that I've been making a purchase of too. So I have the super wide angle, or I don't know, is it super wide? I think it's just a wide angle zoom for that 17 to 40 millimeter F4. I've got the 24 to 70 2A. I would have the 70 to 200 USM F4, and then I would have a couple prime lenses on top of that. So that's like a pretty full collection of glass that I could use to make a whole bunch of different types of art, or, you know, like different photographs, different pieces that I'd be interested in trying to produce. And, you know, like a lot of the film stuff I was building, like all the stuff that was on that film book that I put together, that was almost all done with a Nikon 50 millimeter F1.8. And maybe like a couple manual focus lenses that I should not have been using, actually kind of knowing better now. The optics of those were always kind of...
Thanks a lot for checking out this episode of the Billy Newman Photo Podcast.
Hope you guys check out some stuff on billynewmanphoto.com. A few new things up there, some stuff on the homepage, some good links to other outbound sources, some links to books, some links to some podcasts, links to some blog posts. All pretty cool. But yeah, check it out at billynewmanphoto.com. Thanks a lot for listening to this episode of the podcast. Talk to you next time.